Here it is!
From deep inside your radio.
And cold. Ladies and gentlemen, I've been having a discussion about this upcoming subject with the San Diego desk pre-show today. So he will be bored by the repetition. The rest of you, I hope, will be bored by the novelty. But as you know, I hope, with every major news story, there's a part of it that gets told by the major media, and very often a part that somehow doesn't get told. See a certain documentary from 2010 if you want more, and a good example, an egregious example, but they're all over the place. And so it is with the story I'm surmising by now you must have at least a glancing familiarity with, the story of Donald Sterling, not his real name, owner of the Los Angeles Clippers professional basketball team, who was banned from the league in which the team competes by the league earlier this week after a tape recording, actually two tape recordings, surfaced containing racist remarks by Sterling to his assistant about, among other people, Magic Johnson and the players who play for him, none of whom were nicknamed Magic. And this story has gone all over the place, and the Players Association demanded the maximum penalty for Sterling, and the league exceeded, although they said they didn't exceed. They just decided on their own, not to avoid a boycott or anything. And missing from all the coverage so far, one name, one individual, David Stern. David Stern, until this year, was the commissioner of the National Basketball Association, and a pretty plenipotentiary, thank you, commissioner he was. Here's how powerful he was. A few years ago, Donald Sterling's Clippers were perennial losers, perennial occupants in or near the basement of the division of the league they played in, almost never appeared in playoff games. And playoff games, by the way, are the most profitable tickets that teams sell. So that you want to be in them. But this team was a sad sack, perennial loser, laughing stock, blah, blah, blah. At one moment in time, David Stern, the commissioner of the NBA, was ipso facto also running one of the teams in the league, the New Orleans, then called the Hornets. There was a sale pending. The new owner didn't want to buy because the league was about to go through a strike / lockout. So the league took over the team. And during that time, David Stern mandated a so-called trade that sent the star player of the New Orleans Hornets, Chris Paul, to the Los Angeles Clippers in exchange for three of the guys who had been partly responsible for the team dwelling in the basement. Since that time, the Hornets, now the Pelicans, have not appeared in the playoffs. And since that time, the Clippers have. So you can kind of view the whole transaction as a wealth transfer from a relatively decent ownership, so as far as we know, to one dogged for years by accusations of racism in employment and in the rental of the housing that Donald Sterling owned and built. And yet, not a word of commentary, not a note that any reporter, so-called, in the sports world, had even tried to get comment from David Stern, the man who made Donald Sterling respectable, because now he could swan around with the kind of celebrities who like winning teams. Just an odd note about sports journalism. Ladies and gentlemen, what the frack? The swarm of earthquakes went on for months in north-central Texas, rattling homes with reports of broken water pipes and cracked walls. Locals blaming the shutters on the fracking boom. Leading geophysicists are now saying residents might be right to point the finger at oil and gas activities. Quote, it is certainly possible in large part that is based on what else we've seen in the Fort Worth Basin in terms of the rise of earthquakes since 2008, William Ellsworth, a U.S. Geological Survey seismologist, says in an interview this week. He says the Dallas-Fort Worth region previously had just a single known earthquake way back in 1950. But since 2008, there have been more than 70 big enough to feel. earthquakes, that is. These include ones at the Dallas-Fort Worth airport that scientists linked to a nearby injection well. Ellsworth briefed his colleagues on his findings this week at the Seismological Society of America's annual meeting in Anchorage, Alaska. That's a fun group. They know how to enjoy a convention. Researchers are also investigating links between quakes in Kansas, Oklahoma, Ohio, and elsewhere to oil and gas activities. USGS seismologist Art McGarr said it was clear the deep disposal of drilling waste was responsible for at least some of the earthquakes in the heartland. It's only a tiny fraction of the disposal wells that cause earthquakes large enough to be felt and occasionally cause damage, he said. But there are so many wells distributed throughout much of the United States, they still add significantly to the total seismic hazard. It's well established earthquakes have spiked along with America's fracking boom. More than 100 earthquakes a year on average with a magnitude of 3.0 or more hit the central and eastern United States in the past 4 years, comparing with an average rate of only 20 in the decades from 1970 to 2000. And they do underline that most likely it's not the fracking itself, it's the injection of the waste. Again, it's how do you dispose of the waste, ladies and gentlemen. Oh, you know what? We're not number one. The United States on the rate of deaths per 100,000 childbirths, we're at 18.5 per 100,000. Canada's 8.2. UK 6.1. The United States is among just eight countries in the world to experience an increase in maternal mortality since 2003, joining Afghanistan. Well, they've shared something with us. And countries in Africa and Central America. This according to a new study by the Institute for Health Metrics and Evaluation at the University of Washington. The study, published in The Lancet this week, ranked the United States number 60 in the list of 180 countries on maternal deaths, compared to our rank of 22 in 1990. So we're falling. China rose to number 57, up from number 100. Should have somebody doing a countdown on this. Up from number 116 in 1990. In the U.S., 18.5 mothers died for every 100,000 live births in 2013, more than double the figures for maternal mortality in Saudi Arabia. That's why we're going to be fracking. Got to beat them in something. Hello, welcome to the show. Well, there's some music that's supposed to be playing right now. Doggone it, we're going to make it happen. Right here, right now. Stay tuned, won't you? Apparently, there was no water in the CD machine either. No, it said it was sleeping. From London, where the CD machines never sleep, I'm Harry Shearer, welcoming you to this edition of the show. And now, news of the Olympic movement. From produced by Jim Ebersole, Jr. Dateline, Sydney. John Coates, the vice president of the International Olympic Committee, has called Brazil's preparations for the 2006 Rio Games the worst in his experience and critically behind schedule, warning there is no plan B to find another host. Attending an Olympic forum in Sydney, Coates told delegates construction had not commenced on some venues, infrastructure was significantly delayed, and water quality was also a major concern, as we've shared with you on this broadcast, 2 years away from the Games. The IOC has formed a special task force to try to speed up preparations, but the situation is critical on the ground, he said in a statement on Tuesday. The IOC has adopted a more hands-on role. That's what we need, more hands-on by Olympic committee members. It is unprecedented for the IOC, but there is no plan B. We are going to Rio. We've become very concerned. They are not ready in many, many ways. We have to make it happen, and that is the IOC approach. You can't walk away from this, unquote. Cones and barricades and Kellys sit at the entrance to Olympic Park in Rio. The AOC statement also paraphrased Coates. Why AOC? Oh, Australian Olympic Committee. Paraphrased quotes describing the Olympic preparations in Rio as, quote, the worst I've experienced and, quote, worse than Athens. He added that the host city, Rio, had also social issues that need to be addressed, i.e. bulldoze those poor people away. He didn't say that. But a day after describing the preparations that way, as you've just heard, International Olympic Committee Vice President John Coates says he's confident local organizers and the people of Brazil can indeed deliver excellent games. Eating his words with a nice chasseur sauce, perhaps. He said in a statement dated April 30th, organizers recently took a number of measures designed to make sure we can together deliver a great games and a lasting legacy for the people of Rio and Brazil. Speaking of legacies, the economic legacy from the London Olympics has reached $2.2 billion. How? Because British companies are capitalizing on the event's success to work on the Rio and Tokyo Olympics. The UK has agreed to collaborate with Japan on planning the Tokyo Games, which would lead to further benefits. The Tokyo Games are potentially worth billions to the UK economy. We pump some money out of Japan for the benefit of the Brits. UK companies have won £130 million, about $200 million worth of contracts from Brazil World Cup and Rio Olympic Games. Russia's Winter Olympics in Sochi also brought contracts to UK companies. So this Olympic thing, it's just Mr. Ponzi would be proud, let's put it that way. The Olympics, it's a movement, and we all need one. Every day. Ladies and gentlemen, news of superbugs. Bacteria that resist antibiotics are widespread around the planet, according to the first global review of antibiotic resistance. Resistance is futile, you bacteria. To make matters worse, it is apparently not futile. The World Health Organization, which produced the report, has revealed there is no globally standardized way to assess and share information on drug-resistant infections. This is from New Scientist. Unless we take significant actions to improve efforts to prevent infections and also change how we produce, prescribe, and use antibiotics, the world will lose more and more of these global public health goods, and the implications will be devastating. This is according to the head of health security at the WHO. Who says? That's right. They also point out that without incentives for pharmaceutical companies to develop new antibiotics, we will run out of ways to fight resistant infections. The data in the WHO report raised the specter that most antibiotics could become largely useless while we're still attempting to measure the extent of the problem. Bacteria have increasingly resisted antibiotics since the 50s when they were wonder drugs. When an infection is treated, you know how evolution works. Bacteria with genes that code for enzymes that destroy or exclude the drug survive. If enough bacteria repeatedly encounter the antibiotic, the resistant genes can have enough selective advantage to eventually dominate the population. This happens when the drugs are used too widely or, as is common in the United States, to boost growth in livestock so they can go to market sooner. Hey, cows go to market sooner, but, you know, a scratch on the knee can kill you. It's a trade-off. The problem is expensive. In the United States, it costs the health system $34 billion and knocks 0.4 to 1.6% off gross domestic product every year. I don't know how they figure out those statistics for antibiotic resistance, but it's unable, to conduct a similar economic impact assessment for the whole globe. Maybe that's a good thing, since I suspect the data anyway. Only 114 of its 194 member states had national data on antibiotic resistance. Countries in all regions reported that more than half of Klebsiella infections, that's one of the major kinds of bacteria that infect us, resist antibiotics called third-generation cephalosporins. If those drugs fail, the only ones left are called carbapenems. In some countries in Europe and the eastern Mediterranean regions found more than 50% of Klebsiella infections resisted those as well. So they're now officially untreatable, kind of. At least a quarter of streptococcus infections, which include pneumonia, meningitis, and ear infections, resist penicillin. Gonorrhea that resisted third-generation cephalosporins, making it virtually untreatable, is reported in 10 developed countries, including the UK. Uh-oh. I touched the CD machine here. Oh, no. National authorities and researchers see different bacterial worlds, of course. Tackling the problem will require new antibiotics, but few are being developed because there's little profit in drugs that must be used briefly and sparingly. The pharmaceutical companies would prefer to research drugs for chronic conditions that need to be used for the rest of your natural life. Quote, "In the past, we thought of antibiotics as commercial goods to be sold," says an official of the WHO. "Now we have to think of them as global public goods, which are usually supported by governments." How to do that, he says, is now a vigorous area of discussion. Let's keep big government out of public goods. Can we? Can we do that, please? And now, ladies and gentlemen.
If you want me to love you, all that you must do is just say so.
Well, it's not just me anymore, and maybe it never was. But this week, Fast Company magazine lectured its readers, had a industrial consultant lecture its readers on how business people starting their sentences from out of nowhere or answering questions from out of nowhere with the word so, as if they've been continuing something, are losing credibility, don't you know? And you don't want business officials to lose credibility. Or this guy.
Explain how you did the research.
So the work we've done this time, we've known a little bit about these effects of high CO2 on behaviour for a while from laboratory experiments.
And the place where this occurs the most, these CO2 vents, is in the waters around Papua New Guinea.
So one of the places that these sorts of CO2 events occur is in Papua New Guinea, that's correct.
What are we learning from what you found?
So one of the really important things we've found, apart from the fact that their behaviour is affected, and affected in a way that, for example, would increase the risk of mortality for juvenile fish, and that's obviously not a good thing. But one of the important things we found is that their behaviour doesn't seem to improve.
So what you're saying is that over a period of time, they may not be able to adapt and they will continue to be attracted to the smell of their predators and therefore end up just being a bit like lemmings and just going towards sort of mass suicide.
So what we're seeing is that when they're exposed to conditions similar to what we're predicting will occur later this century, that yes.
So what we're saying is so. Yes, that's The state of the language as we have it now, ladies and gentlemen. And now,
he's not a general. He commands no troops. He's not an inspector. He peeks at no stoops. He's an inspector general.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, yeah.
News of Inspectors General for your listening pleasure. The U.S. Commerce Department found no evidence to support allegations that the monthly unemployment rate was manipulated before the last presidential election, according to the report issued by the agency's Office of Inspector General just this week. Took them a while. The department launched the probe last November after the New York Post, owned by Rupert Murdoch, reported the data used in the closely watched survey was faked in the final stretch of the president's reelection campaign. Have no idea why Rupert Murdoch's newspaper would report something like that in the first place.
Of course, one enjoys the feeling of power.
Okay, well, that explains it. The department launched the probe, as I say, last November. Republicans in the House of Representatives called the allegations shocking and sought documents and communications related to the collection of data for the current population survey, which is used by the Bureau of Labor Statistics to calculate the unemployment rate. The Census Bureau rejected the allegations at the time and denounced the alligators. No, sorry. And said it reported the claims to the Office of Inspector General as soon as it learned of them. The newspaper story, citing anonymous sources, said the Census Bureau had caught an employee faking data for the survey in 2010, and the practice went beyond one employee. It said employees had faked interviews to meet monthly quotas for the survey. But the Office of Inspector General said it exhaustively investigated these allegations and found them to be unsubstantiated. However, during our review, it said, we identified several areas where the Census Bureau could implement policies and improve processes to better prevent survey data falsification. Among the recommendations, implement a formal policy that prohibits any employee suspected of falsifying information from collecting data during the investigative process, and ensuring that supervisors have all available tools to detect and prevent such fraud. Hope that settles that. Goodness gracious, don't want that. And also, on the Inspector General front, the U.S. government posted a deeper loss than initially recorded on the General Motors bailout. Taxpayers lost $11.2 billion on it, up from 10.3 that the Treasury Department estimated when it sold its last GM shares in December, right before Jim had to admit. Now, all that faulty ignition stuff. A Treasury Department auditor said the government had written off an $826 million administrative claim tied to the GM bailout. In March, the figure surfaced in a report by the Office of the Special Inspector General for the Troubled Asset Relief Program, which was charged with overseeing the federal government's bailouts and stimulus programs. The spokesman for the Inspector General could not be reached to provide details about what the nearly $1 billion administrative claim was. News of the Inspector General, ladies and gentlemen, a copyrighted feature of this very broadcast. And now,
once I had a secret that lived within the heart of me, all too soon my secret became impatience to be free. And my secret's no secret anymore.
News of secrets for your listening pleasure. 30 retired generals are urging President Obama to declassify the Senate Intelligence Committee's report on CIA torture. That's the word used by military.com in reporting the story. They argue, the generals do, the retired generals, that without accountability and transparency, the practice of torture could be resumed. Yeah, I think that's what they have in mind, guys. Quote, after taking office, they're writing to the president, you showed decisive leadership by issuing an executive order banning torture and other forms of abusive interrogation, they say. But with former government officials claiming that these techniques were effective, a future president could rescind the ban unless facts in the committee report are known, the generals wrote. The White House did not respond to a request for comment. The signees include retired Major Generals Joseph Hoar and Charles Krulak, Army General David Mattox, and Army Major General Paul Eaton. The letter was released through Human Rights First. Said all the signees are part of a larger nonpartisan group of retired generals and admirals who work with the organization to oppose torture and promote prisoner treatment policies consistent with the Geneva Conventions, which we've signed. The treaties. Law of the land kind of deal. Quote, as retired flag officers of the United States Armed Forces, we believe that our nation is the strongest and on the strongest footing when our defense and security policies adhere to our values and obligations under domestic and international law, unquote, the group's letter said. It's that international law that we're taking seriously now in the Ukraine that we laughed at in Iraq. Quote, the Senate Intelligence Committee voted in early April to release its abbreviated declassified report on the CIA program. That's 500 pages. The full report is more than 6,000 being held pending redaction and declassification. That process itself is under criticism since it's the CIA that would be doing the redacting. The retirees in their letter told Obama it's a conflict of interest to allow the CIA to redact a report that alleges its own officials, including some still on the job, authorized the brutal interrogation methods and systematically misled the White House, Congress, and the American people about the facts and consequences of using those methods. The best chance of avoiding a scenario in which a future president rescinds Obama's executive order banning torture, the group says, is for the Intelligence Committee's report, which calls into question the morality, legality, and effectiveness of the CIA program, to be made public with minimal redactions. News of secrets, ladies and gentlemen. You didn't hear this? I didn't say it. You know, there comes a time in your life when you start paying less attention to the sounds that people make and more attention to the sounds that animals make. You can be young or you can be old, but the time does come. And a couple of places where I hang my hat, New Orleans and Los Angeles, in Los Angeles, the most prominent bird you hear is the crow. Not a very beautiful sound. They're funny creatures. But in both New Orleans and Los Angeles, the most amazing bird you hear on a regular basis is the mockingbird. Just crazy, crazy improvisation, just wild improvisational bird. Here in London, where I'm hanging my hat this week, they don't have that. But especially in the wintertime, and London's winters are notable not just because everybody has cold winters, except New Orleans and Los Angeles. But the darkness of the gray that descends on London is what people here, I think, find, with good reason, particularly depressing. Hence the amazement when, of a winter's night, and they do sing at night, you hear this guy. Now, you may want to close your window eventually and get some sleep. But just that sound, with this dark gray being the only hint of daylight, is a reminder enough that something better will soon come. Probably why the Beatles wrote this song.
Blackbird singing in the dead of night. Take these broken wings and learn to fly. All your life, you were only waiting for this moment to arise. Blackbird, fly. Blackbird, fly. Into the light of a dark black night. For this moment to arise, you were only waiting for this moment to arise. You were only waiting for this moment to arise.
From London, this is Le Show, and now, ladies and gentlemen, News of the Warm, won't you? Copyrighted feature. Award-winning copyrighted feature of this broadcast.
Soft, listen to the warm. We can listen to the warm.
You know, I don't know why anybody would want to use ice sheets. They don't really keep you warm at night. Shrinking ice sheets and melting ice caps are well-known consequences of climate change, but a new study reveals that impacts on biodiversity will be just as severe in other parts of the world as in the polar regions. When multiple dimensions of climate change are analyzed, different regions emerge as threatened by different aspects of climate change. The tropics, for example, will be highly affected by local changes in temperature and precipitation, leading to novel climates with no current analogs on the planet. Whole new climates! These results published in Science expose the complexities of climate change effects on biodiversity and the challenges in predicting and preserving natural ecosystems, at least the ones we have now, in a changing Earth. Polar regions have gained substantial attention because they're experiencing a very high temperature increase. Polar climates will shrink an area, providing reduced habitat for Arctic and subarctic species. But climate change is more than melting ice. Warming in the tropics will create entirely novel climatic conditions currently not experienced by species anywhere on Earth. Whether species will be able to adapt to these novel climates is an open question. There's a risk of neglecting such vital information because the temperature increase in the polar regions is easier to grasp in comparison. This is all the words of Miguel Aranjo, chair in integrative biogeography at Imperial College London, who did this study. And as climate change melts Arctic permafrost and releases large amounts of methane into the atmosphere, it's creating a feedback loop that is certain to trigger additional warming, according to the head scientist of a new study investigating Arctic methane emissions. The study released this week examined 71 wetlands across the globe and found that melting permafrost is creating wetlands known as fens. They're fens, which are unexpectedly emitting large quantities of methane. So if you want to load up on methane, go to your local neighborhood fen. Over a 100-year time frame, methane is about 35 times as potent as a climate change driving greenhouse gas as carbon dioxide. Over 20 years, it's 84 times more potent. Methane emissions come from agricultural fossil fuel production and microbes in wetland soil. The study says scientists have assumed that methane emissions from wetlands are high in the tropics, but not necessarily the Arctic because of the cold temperatures there. But a spike in global methane concentrations in the atmosphere seen since 2007 can be traced back to the formation of fens in areas where permafrost once existed, according to the study led by University of Guelph, Ontario, Canada, biology professor Merit Turetsky. The methane emissions stemming from melting permafrost could be critical to determining how fast the climate will change in the future. Methane emissions are one example of a positive feedback between ecosystems and the climate system, according to the author. The permafrost carbon feedback is important and likely consequence of climate change. It's certain to trigger additional warming. Warming and thawing permafrost stimulate methane release, which enhances the greenhouse effect, creating a feedback loop, she said. Even if we ceased all human emissions, permafrost would continue to thaw and release carbon into the atmosphere. There's no way to capture emissions from thawing permafrost. This carbon is released from soils across very large regions of land in very remote spaces. A methane vacuum. Mr. Dyson? News of the Warm, ladies and gentlemen. Copyrighted. I'm just blue skying here, but a copyrighted feature of this broadcast now. News of... Ah, fuck! Opium cultivation is expected to be an all-time high in Afghanistan, despite the U.S. spending $7.5 billion to combat it. That's according to a report released this week by the Afghanistan War Watchdog, the Special Inspector General for Afghanistan Reconstruction. It found that the billions spent by the State and Defense Departments on counter-narcotics since 2002 has been for naught. Zero, zip, nada, zilch. Opium poppy cultivation takes up 516,000 acres of land in Afghanistan, a 36% increase since just 2 years ago. And drug use inside Afghanistan has spiked. They're not only producing, they're consuming. That's according to the CIGAR as well. About 1.3 million Afghan adults were regular drug users in 2012, up from a million in 2009. Population is just under 32 million. The interdiction efforts that the U.S. and its Afghan partners continue to perform are concentrated in eastern Afghanistan and the capital of Kabul. That's not the areas of cultivation. The Inspector General says this is because the U.S. forces are being drawn down and the threat of attack in the areas where they're actively fighting drugs is the threat of attack in those areas is generally less than the threat in the south and southwest where the drugs are grown, you see. So why not fight them where they're not and but where you won't get killed? Drug lab storage sites and major trafficking networks are concentrated in rural areas that are increasingly off limits to Afghan forces due to the drawdown. The U.S.-led coalition shifted away from eradication in recent years owing to a conclusion that crop destruction drove farmers and those dependent on them into the hands of the Taliban. The administration once implored Afghans to grow pomegranates instead. Talk to the lady. She makes the juice. And a former commander of U.S. and NATO forces in Afghanistan says corruption, not the Taliban, is the worst threat to the future of the war-torn country. Retired General John Allen says the Taliban are, quote, an annoyance, unquote, compared to widespread corruption in Afghanistan. He says the Afghans need time to improve leadership skills and technical know-how, which will allow them to mitigate the threat from the Taliban going forward. And there's reports of violence within the Pakistani Taliban, reportedly stemming from a disagreement over whether they should focus on going back across the border to help their brothers in Afghanistan or to focus on fighting the Pakistani government. All of this sounds weird from here. How does it sound from there?
From Afghanistan Public Radio, where our news coverage is never influenced by our corporate underwriters. And you can take that to the bank. Afghan Bank. We make you feel like a customer.
From the slowly transitioning presidential palace in downtown Kabul, the city where government works, I'm Mahmoud.
And I'm Hamid. We're Split and Splat, the Out of Here Brothers. Welcome to another edition of Karzai Talk. Today's program comes to you with the assistance of the Opium Foundation, reminding you to shoot up responsibly.
Well, my younger brother, We have a few more weeks to pack our things.
That's right. The presidential election resulted in a runoff, And that won't happen until June. So for a few more weeks, I get to ride in Car Force One.
My goodness, it took so long to get the election results, but the exit polls turned out to be very accurate.
Oh, yes. Everybody they predicted would leave the polls actually did. And now it's a race between two of my closest friends, one of them a respected Pashtun, and the other a member of some other tribe.
That would be Abdallah Abdallah, The man so nice, they named him twice.
Yes, he was my foreign minister, enjoying a very sweet job in this government, before I guess he decided that blood is thicker than honey.
But seriously, the Tajiks are a wonderful tribe. Very clever people.
Oh, really?
Yes. They know how to get along well, even in very hard times.
Which have been all times lately.
Yes. You know what their staple diet is?
No, what?
Staples.
Hello, you're on Karzai Talk, the final days.
Hello, this is Abdul, a long-time member of the Pakistani Taliban, first-time caller.
Probably last-time caller, if the drone guys are tracking your cell phone.
No, the Pakistani Taliban switched back to landlines a couple of years ago.
Really? That must make it hard to coordinate when you're out on a remote killing spree.
Well, you pay extra, you can get a very long, windy cord.
Oh, but don't they always knot up at the worst times?
Yes, and when Afghan Telecom ran out of the sandy-colored cords, the black ones snaking across the countryside were kind of a tip-off.
Well, as the old saying goes, nobody ever said it's easy being an insurgent.
Well, that's the problem. Mullah Omar, did say it was easy.
Well. Hey, look, if you catch him before we do, you can teach him the cost of violating old sayings.
Do you have a question, Abdul? Even in our closing minutes, the producer wants us to stick to the format.
Yes, I do. We've been having some very spirited discussions over here over whether our priorities should be going back over the border to help our Taliban brothers regain your country, or to focus on our fight against the Pakistani government here at home.
When you say spirited discussions, you mean...
I mean three of my brothers had their throat slit last week.
Well, I don't watch much American TV, but I'd say that's meaner than crossfire.
So, Hamid, what do you think?
Well, obviously, keeping the Taliban from taking over this country again doesn't guarantee continued American assistance.
No, I think the only discovering productive shale formations here would do that.
But certainly it couldn't hurt. Mm. So, given our Pakistani brothers continued meddling in our affairs, I think it's only fair for me to say, go get them.
And when you do, tell them Hamid sent you.
Yes, that's right.
Well, thank you. I'll bring it up at the next neck slitting.
Oh, yes. Thanks for the call.
You know, we forget how far we've come since the Taliban ruled here.
Oh, it's true. When they ran this network, we couldn't have had a theme tune.
unless it was the call to prayer.
For once in our career, I think it's a good idea not to laugh at one of our jokes.
Hello, you are on Karzaitok.
Hello, this is Najibullah, a long-time puppy farmer. First time caller.
Well, always happy to talk with a listener from the agricultural sector. You know, you share a name with a former prime minister.
Yes, well, in a country where most of us don't use last names, you've got to share a name with somebody.
Well, that's one of the promises the Americans never kept. They said by the time they left, every Afghan would have a last name.
That's not true. That's so not true. Yeah. So, listener, what can we do for you?
And don't say send fertilizer. Our listeners say we do plenty of that already.
Well, it's not really a farming question per se.
Oh, that's good. Because my brother isn't a farming expert per se.
No, I have yet to kill my first spotted aphid.
You haven't missed anything. But I did want to ask, when we do complete a day's harvest, and we have all the tarjak from the poppies ready for collection in the morning.
Yes, yes.
And at that moment, the police come by.
Yes.
Is it possible the police can take Visa or MasterCard for the bribe out here with the retreating American vehicles clogging the roads? Mm. It's so hard to get to the bank much before noon.
You know what? Here's a tip. You can call in and charge the bribe the night before. That way the police don't even have to come by. It's win-win.
Just use the emergency number. They should answer that one. Good luck with the aphids and thanks for the call. We had help today from the Afghanistan Election Commission, making your vote count since nearly 3 weeks ago.
Legal services for Cars I Talk from the law firm of Ketchum and Newcomb.
Empty cardboard boxes for our move, courtesy of the U.S. Air Force, but don't tell them we took them. I'm Hamid.
And I'm Mahmoud.
Join us again sometime for another edition of Cars I Talk. This is APR, Afghanistan Public Radio.
And now, ladies and gentlemen, the apologies of the week.
We're so sorry.
You know that show Top Gear? It's one of the most popular shows internationally. It originates from the BBC. And I think it's on BBC America in the United States. And it features Jeremy Clarkson talking about cars and doing a lot of stuff with cars. And this week, he issued a video apology.
Ordinarily, I don't respond to newspaper allegations, but on this occasion, I feel I must make an exception. A couple of years ago, I recorded an item for Top Gear in which I quoted the rhyme "Eeny, meeny, miny, moe." Now, of course, I was well aware that in the best-known version of this rhyme, there is a racist expression that I was extremely keen to avoid. The full rushes show that I did three takes. In two, I mumbled where the offensive word would normally occur, and in the third, I replaced it altogether with the word teacher. Now, when I viewed this footage several weeks later, I realized that in one of the mumbled versions, if you listen very carefully with the sound turned right up, it did appear that I'd actually used the word I was trying to obscure. I was mortified by this, horrified. It is a word I loathe, and I did everything in my power to make sure that that version did not appear in the program that was transmitted. In fact, I have here the note I sent at the time to the production office, and it says, "I didn't use the N-word here, but I've just listened through my headphones and it sounds like I did. Is there another take that we could use? Please be assured, I did everything in my power to not use that word. And that I'm sitting here begging your forgiveness for the fact that obviously my efforts weren't quite good enough. Thank you."
How good were his efforts? Here is the outtake.
Eeny, meeny, miny, moe. Hasn't he? When he squeals, let him go. Eeny, meeny, miny, moe.
The word is tiger, Jeremy. Tiger. Representative David Lifferth, whose tweets calling the NAACP a racist organization in the aftermath of the ouster of L.A. Clippers owner Donald Sterling, made national headlines. He apologized Thursday and deleted his messages. "My joke was in poor taste and insensitive to others," Lifferth wrote in a blog post. "I've learned a lot in the last few days. The NAACP is not a racist organization. My logic was flawed." Dateline Salt Lake City, Utah. Well, these are two NBA-related apologies. Let's start with Shaquille O'Neal. Dateline Detroit ex-NBA star Shaquille O'Neal has apologized to a Detroit man with a rare disorder. O'Neal apologized for making fun of the man's appearance in an online post. He announced the apology in a Twitter message this week. "Made a new friend today when I called and apologized to Jamel Binion. Great dude," the tweet said. O'Neal personally wrote his tweet, "Binion has ectodermal dysplasia, which affects his face, teeth, and hair." He was confused when O'Neal posted a picture on Instagram showing him making a face imitating Binion. "I was thinking, man, he's supposed to be this role model. Everyone's supposed to look up to him. If Shaq does something like this," Binion said, "everyone who follows him will think we should do this." The post by Shaq was taken down. And Dateline Salt Lake City, Utah Jazz guard Trey Burke apologized for his insensitive post on Instagram that mocked Binion. Burke, as well as Shaquille, and Rappa, Waka Flocka, Flame, were each criticized for making fun of him. All three have since apologized publicly for their insensitive social media posts. And South Korean President Park Geun-hye apologized Tuesday for her government's failure to prevent the ferry disaster that left some 300 people dead or missing. 2 days after her prime minister resigned over the tragedy, Park voiced profound regret at the systemic and regulatory failings that contributed to the capsizing of the 6,800-ton seawall on April 16th. "I feel so regretful for having been unable to correct such long-running evils and letting an accident like this take place," she said in a statement to her cabinet that was broadcast on national television. Apologies of the week, ladies and gentlemen. Copyrighted feature of this broadcast. John Oliver on HBO wanted more coverage of the Indian election on American media. Here you go, John. "Rats have caused chaos in the latest round of voting in elections in India after they destroyed dozens of electronic vote counting machines by eating the cables." You're welcome.
I've got a friend and he can't see living the high life. I might just be the perfect disguise for someone who's in pain.
looks at the bar and he tells me he tries really hard, then he might just be a beautiful star, 'cause that's all he really needs to make him well inside. And Callie, you're running out of time. Callie, you're going down in style. Swallow your pride, get on a train out of Hollywood. Look at me, I've been such a fool, thinking fame would do what only time can do, hoping I would be alright if I could have a perfect life, just like you. Hey, get on a train out of Hollywood. Get on a train. Can't get on a train before you lose your ass, your everything.
Just wondering why the teacher's union isn't bad at Jeremy Clark. Catch a teacher by the toe. Tiger, babe. Tiger. That's going to conclude, ladies and gentlemen, this week's edition of the show. The program returns next week at the same time over these same stations over NPR worldwide throughout Europe. You send 440 cable system in Japan, around the world via the Armed Forces, American Forces Network. Going back in time a little bit. On the Mighty 104 in Berlin. Available via the internet at two different locations, live and archive whenever you want, at kcsn.org and harryshearer.com. Available through the Mighty 104 in Berlin. Did I mention them already? How about for your smartphone through stitcher.com? Available as a free podcast at wwno.org, soundcloud.com, Sideshow Network, and iTunes. And it'd be just like Jeremy Clarkson having a little bit more power to prevent saying that, if you'd agree to join with me then. Would you already? Thank you very much. Uh-huh. Show chapeau to the San Diego, Pittsburgh, Chicago, and Exile, and Hawaii desks. Thanks, as always, to Pam Halstead. Thanks to Jenny Lawson at WWNO New Orleans. And thanks to Adrian Bodnam, the newly housed Bodders here at Global Radio in London, for help with today's broadcast. The email address for this program and the playlist of the music heard here on available at harryshearer.com. Same place you'll find Cars I Talk t-shirts. Need I say more? Or less? And if, as some writers have speculated this week, Twitter is dying, I'm sitting there dying with it at the Harry Shearer. The show comes to you from Century of Progress Productions and originates through the facilities of WWNO New Orleans, flagship station of the Change is Easy radio network. So long from sunny London.